KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Elmwood, Berkeley.
I live in Mahate.
North-ish, Oakland.
I live in the Western Addition.
Lake Merritt.
The Twin Peaks.
I'm from the Outer Sunset, and I love it.
Coming up, the controversial proposal to shift Delta water flow in the San Joaquin River towards struggling fisheries and away from farms.
So that the fish's voice would be thrown into the mix rather than ignored.
Then we'll hear what you have to say about how to solve BART's funding challenges.
$4 million gates. Wow! I've got a used toaster I'd love to sell to BART.
And we'll catch up with one of the godfathers of San Francisco's psychedelic art movement.
The bell had gone off in my head that I should be a poster artist. It was the art world that I wanted to be a part of.
It's Cross Currents coming up. Late summer in Sacramento has been busy. Governor Brown signed a law eliminating bail in California, and lawmakers just passed a bill that would require the state to get all its energy from carbon-free sources by the year 2045. That's the most ambitious clean energy goal in the nation. But for our environment reporter, Angela Johnston, the proposal that drew her attention most was about water. The past month, there have been debates over how to manage the water in the Delta, the Bay Area's largest source of fresh water. And Angela joins me now to tell us more about this. Hey, Angela.
Hello.
So what's going on with this Bay Area Delta plan?
So the Bay Delta plan has been around for a while. It was last updated in 2006, way before the last drought. And this new proposal is going to shift some of the water flow in the San Joaquin River toward struggling fisheries mm-hmm. and away from farms. Mm-hmm. And the California State Water Resources Control Board proposed this a few months ago in July, but they've been working on this proposal for almost a decade.
Okay, so what's in it?
So the plan would require what's called the unimpaired flow of the San Joaquin River and its three tributaries. Those are the Stanislaus, Merced, and Tuolumne Rivers. And so that flow would have to be 40% during February to June. And that means 40% of the river's water would have to be, quote, unaltered by upstream diversions, storage, export, import of water. Mm-hmm. So originally it was going to be 60% that would be unaltered, but the State Water Resources Control Board cited that it would be too much of an economic burden to water users if they did that. So they suggested 40.
Okay, so that means less water for farms and more for the fish.
Correct. And they were supposed to vote on it in August, but because there was so much pressure from both sides of the issue, they've now delayed that decision until November, just after the election on November 7th. So people who are against the plan are calling it water theft or a water grab.
Okay, so why do they want to increase the fresh water flow? What's the reasoning behind that?
Because of the fish, mainly. Salmon runs are in danger, and another type of fish, the Delta smelt, are pretty much gone. And California has this Endangered Species Act, and their argument is that we need to keep water in the river if we want to protect these species. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there are other uses of the Delta. It's not just a habitat for fish. It's where California's two largest rivers converge. There's incoming seawater from the Pacific, and it's this hub of California's water supply system and one of the most valuable estuaries and wetlands on the West Coast. So it serves not only farms, but also cities. And farmers are really not happy about this. But there's also different communities, boaters, all different types of wildlife that are in the Delta.
So there's a stake.
There's many different stakeholders. Mm. So here's Felicia Marcus. She's the chairwoman of the State Water Resources Control Board, explaining the board's justification.
What was called a flow criteria report that basically was about if the fish could talk, what would the fish ask for as a counterpoint to what the water suppliers had been asking for, so that as we moved into this planning process, both at the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and in the Water Board, that the fish's voice would be thrown into the mix rather than ignored.
So, Angela, how would this affect people here in the San Francisco Bay Area?
Well, this is what I find really interesting. Here in San Francisco, our water comes from the Tuolumne River,
right,
which flows into the San Joaquin Delta. So this unimpaired flow proposal would mean that we need to reduce water. San Francisco Public Utilities Commission would need to reduce the amount of water that went to San Francisco customers. San Francisco has actually come out really strongly against the plan. They've sided with the farmers and not with the environmentalists, which surprises some people because San Francisco has this reputation of being this really environmentally conscious city. But they feel that the state's economy, the city's economy is only growing, mm-hmm. and cities like San Francisco will need more water in the future, even maybe if this may drive some fish species extinct. Mm. So the city, San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, is worried they wouldn't be able to provide water in another drought if there were reductions in flow. But proponents of the plan say there's no way that would ever happen, and mm-hmm. San Francisco could do even more water recycling and saving, even though we already do a lot.
Okay, so that's San Francisco. What about other places around the Bay?
Well, the Delta is the eastern edge of the Bay Area, so there are farmers in the Bay Area that would probably be affected by this plan. Mm-hmm. But what's also interesting is that there are a lot of other cities, 26 actually, in the Bay Area that get their water from the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. And even though the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission has opposed the plan, a city like Palo Alto, which gets its water from SFPUC, has unanimously voted to support it.
So these are mostly on the peninsula.
Yeah, mostly mm-hmm. on the peninsula. So there are individual cities that have come out for and against it. Mm-hmm. Generally, water agencies and irrigation districts oppose the proposal because it would require them to give up significant share of the water that they already use.
So you've told us before about the twin tunnels proposed that would also divert water from the Delta. This isn't the same thing, right?
No, it's not the same thing, although I can definitely understand why it would be confusing because they both have to do with water in the Delta. Mm-hmm. The California Water Fix is a separate project. It would take water from the Delta with two tunnels, bring it down to Southern California. And mm-hmm. that is contentious as well. There's been lots of votes on that. But it's different from the Delta plan, and it will be subject to flow and other conditions to protect legal users of water and fish and wildlife.
Okay, we'll be following. Thank you, Angela.
Thanks.
Angela Johnston is our environment reporter. You can reach her at environment@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Every morning, our team talks about the news of the day, the stories that shape the Bay Area. And a couple of weeks back, an article really caught our attention. It said BART figures that it loses about $25 million every year by people jumping the gates and not paying for their rides. The agency said it could replace the gates, but that would cost something like $150 million. Okay, that's a lot of money, and we kicked around some solutions and then decided it would be interesting to hear what our audience thinks. So we put the question to you on Facebook. What do you think BART should do to reduce fare evasion? We got plenty of responses. Here are just some of them with the voices portrayed by people right here at KALW.
Install them only at key stations.
Replace a few station gates a year, and in 10 years or so, it would be all done.
That's four $250,000 gates. Wow! I've got a used toaster I'd love to sell to BART.
More fare inspectors might help. I've ridden BART several times a week since they started the fare enforcement program, and I've been checked exactly once. The likelihood of having your fare checked seems very low.
More BART security seems like it would help in more ways than just one.
Hire more police. Lower fares.
This is the era of digital media. Livestream the emergency exits that fare evaders use and offer a reward of half the fine to be split among anyone who identifies an evader. Also, post on the BART website images of fare evaders.
Public transportation should be cheap. It's not. Until it becomes free or affordable, people will keep jumping. A gate to keep them out is not going to increase ridership all that much. Would you rather the seats be empty, or is this a class war tactic where you just need a reason to discriminate? If my tax dollars went to fund BART in any way, can I ask for my money back? We don't want to give away free rides.
Make BART free.
Make an affordable, reliable, convenient service people want to support.
Make it free.
Public transportation should have been made free 50 years ago to get so many cars off the road.
Lots of people are commenting, make BART free. So here is the BART 2017 budget. Go figure out how BART can be free while still operating and let us all know how you did it.
What are the make it free folks here actually thinking? Significant taxes for all? I'd be in favor of that myself, but it'd be a very hard row to hoe.
Make public transportation truly public. No fares for residents of counties along the system, and do away with most enforcement costs / apparatus. Maybe scale back enforcement to a show proof of residency or buy a ticket booth at the two airports in Caltrain. Amtrak connections for tourists.
Have programs for low income? I mean, Muni has it.
Those voices represented the thoughts of some of you, the members of our audience. Thank you all for sharing your ideas, and keep those comments coming on our Facebook page. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Artist Lee Conklin arrived in San Francisco shortly after the Summer of Love. He got into the rock and roll scene and had dreams of making artwork for concerts. And it happened. He was hired by promoter Bill Graham to design show posters for venues like Fillmore West and the Winterland Ballroom. And Lee went on to sketch the iconic lion image that appeared on Santana's debut album cover. These days, a Lee Conklin original can go for upwards of $1,000. And while the liquid light shows may have faded, Lee's imagination and vision haven't. At 77 years old, he's still cranking out pieces of work from his Central California studio. And this month, the Haight Street Arts Center in San Francisco is honoring his work with an exhibit celebrating his 50 years of psychedelic art. In this piece produced by KALW's Beau Walsh, we meet the man behind the drawings.
My name is Lee Daniel Conklin. That's who I am. I'm an artist. That's always been the case as far as I can remember. If I had a pencil, I needed a piece of paper. And if I had a crayon, I was going nuts. It hasn't always been exactly profitable, but it's always been a version of that same impulse that I had back then. As a child, I did copy the cartoonists too, or imitate them. I tried to make my own cartoons. And then, of course, Mad Magazine was the big source for me at the time. I came there on purpose because it looked like it was really the center of the world. The bell had gone off in my head that I should be a poster artist. And I went out onto Haight Street and with my portfolio and showed it to this to the man behind the counter at the print mint, thus a poster shop. And he looked through it, and I told him I wanted to be a poster artist. What should I do next? And he told me to go over and see Bill Graham. So I did. I mean, what? And yeah, okay, come on in. And he goes through my sketchbook and says, can you turn this into a poster by Monday morning? This was Friday afternoon. And I said, yeah, mm-hmm. That's how that started for us. I was there for the poster action. It was the art world that I wanted to be a part of. And we actually got there too late for the Summer of Love, I hear. that you know, all the good acid had already been taken and nothing was quite the same anymore. January 1968 was my first poster. Vanilla Fudge was the lead one, but it was quite a bill. Steve Miller was in it. He was a backup. There was Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, two real old timers from the Memphis era. It's really neat that I got to do a Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee poster. They probably never had a poster in their life before, but they were wonderful musicians. And that poster has had a sort of a life of its own. It's the one with the two hands that are clenched and but have bodies instead of coming out of arms. And I call it the moon dance. The moon is right behind me. At some point in my childhood, I had an epiphany with lettering that, oh, this was a subject to draw too. It wasn't. It was more than just something we use to communicate, and you can make it float and do all sorts of good things with it. Probably I should have turned into a sign painter, but it's kind of a good thing I didn't. They lost their jobs too. A robot. I would take a clue, like from the name. My cream poster has a lettering that looks like, that tries to look like cream pouring down, and that's a popular thing with me to try and embody the word in the picture and make lettering turn into what it says it is. It's been a theme that I've worked for 3 years now. I haven't given up on yet either. Although I certainly experimented with LSD and I probably got some useful ideas that are still bouncing around in my head, I was an artist. I wasn't a mystic or anything. I wanted to make pictures, and I did find that my old way of finding the creative space, which required a kind of sleep deprivation because you just stay at it. But I did find that marijuana is a great shortcut. Yeah, but. I was pretty much a hermit type, glued to the drawing board. I did go to shows, especially if there's somebody who really attracted me at the time. But a lot of the time, it was just I felt the pressure to if I didn't actually have a deadline looming at me, I had my own deadline for what'll I do next. Well, Santana is part of this story because they are on the poster that had the lion's head on it originally. Then Carlos came to me, hey, could you redraw that for my first album cover? Well, I'd already been listening to that, all the demos of that album for probably 6 months already, and I knew it was going to be when it hit the nationwide thing that was going to go, and so I was thrilled for the opportunity to do it. And boy, they just really burst onto the scene with that, and I got to be part of it. And it was actually it was a pretty amazing drawing too. I knew I had done something special that that night that I kept going all night because I was to finish that first idea of that drawing. And it went on. Of course, it's been around the world and into every culture you can imagine. I didn't know at the time at all, and I did have plenty of time to find out about all the other uses they made of the image and never reimbursed me for. And that if I choose to dwell on that, I suppose I could be a bitter man, but I'm the guy who did the Santana cover, so you know, that's enough for me. Yeah, I feel justified, you know. I haven't drawn the big bucks, but I've got the great strokes.
You can check out the Lee Conklin exhibit, 50 Years of Psychedelic Art, through the end of the month at the Haight Street Art Center in San Francisco. Check out klw.org for the details. And don't forget, while you're there, subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's free, it highlights our best stories, and sometimes it's psychedelic. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Zoe Ferrigno, Nina Gensler-Deb, Sarah Harrison, Mary Franklin Harvin, Angela Johnston, Sarah Coast, Lisa Morehouse, Drew Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Priscilla Wilson, and Eli Wertschafter. Gabe Graben, Tarek Foda, and James Rollins engineer the show. Shireen Adil is our content manager. Jen Sheehan is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. Muslim leaders are having to jump through a lot of hoops to open a community center in the South Bay.
Costco, big companies, Shell Oil, you'd expect them to have to do an EIR. But a small community, religious community, to have to take this burden is really questionable.
Proper protocol or Islamophobia? We'll investigate tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KLW News. This music is by Terabyte from Oakland. The songwriter will perform at the Honey Hive in San Francisco tomorrow night. Show starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.